Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth. We've been thoroughly traumatised this week by both Avengers Endgame and that big thing that happened in Game of Thrones, so much so that we're going to give over to an all Alan Bennett, Belen Sebastian and Sufjan Stevens format from now on. We are simply too shattered to go on. I'm Andrew Harrison and with me I have Sean Pattenden, the indestructible Gamora, to my flea-bitten rocket raccoon. How are you doing?
I'm alright, thank you.
How are your trauma levels?
Oh, I'm fine. Yeah. That trauma, it just went over my head.
You didn't watch Game of Thrones then?
No, I've given up on Game of Thrones. Too many dragons.
We're going to be talking about Avengers Endgame at the very end of the show in a special spoiler-laden annex with our specialist geek squad of Linda Marek and Michael Moran. It's all had time to sink in. You've all seen it by now, and if you haven't, we're going to give you ample warning to switch off. But first, we have a very special guest with us for the main show. Dave Ball is 50% of Soft Cell, who reunited last year for one night only, and 50% of The Grid, the Ken Keseys of rave and occasional banjo-assisted hitmakers. Hello, Dave. How you doing?
Hello.
Welcome to Big Mouth.
I like the introduction.
I am available for weddings and things like that. How did it feel to be like on the O2 stage for that one-off comeback thing?
Unbelievable. I mean, I thought I was going to be nervous, but it was like I sort of walked on and it just kind of felt really good. It was like, I mean, back in the day when, you know, in the heyday when we'd take loads of drugs before we went on stage, it was like that was a completely drug-free experience. I walked on and it felt like the biggest high of my career, really.
Wow.
It was, I mean, just to see that amount of people, it's just like, and with the reception was phenomenal.
Were you thinking, oh my God, maybe we should have done it like this in the past?
Maybe we should have.
Just start off with a herbal tea and
maybe
you can
we should have had a better manager and it could have sorted. maybe we could have been Depeche Mode. You know?
It was a big investment, not necessarily of money, but of time and thought and energy and commitment for just one show. Mm. I mean, usually, like, when a band does a show or begins a tour or a comeback show and can kind of knock the kinks out of it, think, oh, we'll change this for later on. Did you come off thinking, maybe we should be doing a tour here?
I've always maintained, as I don't say it's the very last thing, because we've spent months doing the pre-production and rehearsing, getting all the visual artists together and, you know, reprogramming all the music and everything. So a lot of pre-production went into it and it costs a lot of money and stuff. But, you know, we could do sort of 10 shows around the world like that in a year and you could retire, you know. And it's also, it's great, it's a great way of, you know, a lot of people getting to see you, you know. I think Mark was quite adamant that he didn't want to do it again. But the great thing about it, I think, is there's going to be a DVD coming out, which is, I've seen it and it looks fantastic. And it's just a great reminder of that night for people that were there and people that couldn't make it. It's a
top pop secret. Often groups with their live shows will record more than one show and take out a bad bit and put in a good bit. You don't have that option. There are any bits in there where you think, oh God, I wish you could do that bit again.
Yes. Of course. Well, let's just say I was using a lot of live analog synthesizers, and they are prone, especially when you're kind of sound checking in an empty venue, you know, that they're all perfectly in tune, and then you're not on stage for 2 hours, you go in the dressing room, and then you come back on, and they've sort of drifted quite a bit because all the people have come in, so the temp and the lights have come on, so the temperatures affect the sort of oscillators, particularly on the older keyboards. And so you sort of, the first couple of numbers kind of struggling a bit with just getting the oscillators in tune, but it's kind of, at least people know it's real.
So we should be going back to Kieran Prendeville on Tomorrow's World in 1978, whatever, and saying, you know what, they're not as reliable as real musicians, you know, they have got minds of their own. We're going to talk about soft cells.
Have you ever watched early Kraftwerk? I mean, when Kraftwerk were on that legendary appearance on Tomorrow's World, and they've got the sort of an ARP Odyssey and a Mini Moog. And it was so out of tune. They were just wandering all over. Unless it was Kraftwerk, who were now like so pristine and perfect. And it was like, whoa, it's like, you know, I'm sure that Ralph Hutter would probably rather delete that bit of history. But
I guess that's why I like out of tune music. We're going to talk about Soft Cell's comeback and The Grid a little bit more later in the show. But you've got a book of memorabilia coming out called To Show You I've Been There. Yeah. And the very first words are, as I sift through all the images in this book, I found it hard to believe that I was once a very shy, withdrawn young man who hated the idea of having his photo taken.
Well, it's true. I did say, because, I mean, I've got a very rough copy of it and I can give you, because I'll never remember all the names, but I mean, it really charts our kind of history, which is about sort of, about 40 years, you know. And it, I mean, so you've got some really amazing photographers, but mainly, I mean, Peter Ashworth, who was the kind of the most iconic photographer of the early 80s, who did that Mavericks exhibition reason. It was people like Annie Lennox, Adam and the Ants, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, us, you know, just like a who's who of early 80s pop. But so there's Peter and there's people like my good friend Dave Chambers, Paolo Di Paolo, who's quite a legend. Yeah. There's, I mean, they're all kind of legends, really, and there's a lot of Getty Images. Mike Owen, who we kind of did some stuff with quite recently. I mean, it's a big list of people, and the quality of the printing is fantastic.
Well, we're going to have a look at that.
We're very proud of it.
Excellent. We're going to have a look at that a little bit later. We have another guest with us, do we not, Sean?
We do. It's returning Big Mouth regular Martin Aston, renowned music journo at Q and Mojo, author of Breaking Down the Walls of Heartache, How Music Came Out, The Story of Pop's Gay DNA, and also, conversely, The Story of 4AD, which does what it says on the four-dimensional holographic Vaughan Oliver design tin, and is very good. He is also DJ Care Home, who uses music to combat memory loss and dementia among older people in residential care up and down the country. So he is a good person.
A very good person.
He needs to be here. Hello, Martin. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I don't know how good I am, because I haven't actually, you know, got out of London to do this. So I'm only good within the
N25,
really.
Well, that's where dementia is worse than the N25.
Well, it's all the traffic.
Yes.
It's all the,
London,
you know,
yes,
pollution levels.
Yes.
But,
is Tainted Love a regular in the DJ Care Home record box? Say yes.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Generally, no. I mean, they're you have to think of your target audience and what the age, you know, what the age range is. And generally, the age range is more slightly 70 plus, I think.
Right. So Gloria Jones?
Maybe Tainted. You know, I should play Tainted Love and see who actually gets out of their chair. Because, you know, what's so great about playing music is that somebody who really doesn't move for most of their time, when you actually see them in the care home, you can put on a track, and honest to God, they do start moving and getting up, and that's just an extraordinary moment. Mm. And it's maybe it's the same
that's
as being on stage at at the O2. It's completely drug.
The old two.
It's the old two. That's what the O stands for. It's a real drug-free high to see. Yeah. You know, people really reacting to music, and I should try with
but there must
Tainted
be
Love. It would,
yeah,
you know, tap a foot.
Yeah. A group dynamic, though. So when one person gets up, does it encourage other people to get up? Is there a kind of collective
thing? Is there some kind of domino effect?
Yeah.
No, not really. I think everyone is in there. I mean, it's very difficult to... Everyone is probably, in a sense, in their own space and reacts in their own way. But it's of course, I'm not really taking notes to see, oh, that person's that, and then the next person, that person. But
yeah.
There is a kind of group vibe. And I think that when there is a sort of energy in the room, people are much more liable to be singing along. You know, because people really, you know, music is the first thing that you really learn. When you're a baby, apparently music is the first thing that goes in. So it's the last thing that leaves. So you can have somebody who really is inactive and you'll play a song that they'll know, and they can start mouthing the words or even sing. It is an extraordinary thing to see and hear.
Now, Soft Cell must feature in Breaking Down the Walls of Heartache. This is the area of the ambiguous pop star. Mark Boyd George,
yeah,
Tennant,
absolutely,
totally come out,
absolutely,
maybe?
And I mean, you've also got, you know, you were talking Depeche Mode, and even though they are all heterosexuals, the way that they dressed
Martin
was kind
Gore.
Of out of like a sort of gay man's marketing dream, really.
Yes.
I mean, you know, leathers, peak caps. Yeah. I mean, it was just in the air, and you know, obviously, you know, Frankie, it was. I mean, you had David Bowie and you had glam rock, but everything was still kind of sort of on the down low, in the sense that people who were saying that, you know, they were bisexual were also married, you know, Bowie and Lou Reed. Yeah. But Mark will say at the time he didn't actually come out for a long time because he was really kind of scared of the reaction pretty much in his hometown of Leeds. He felt, you know, there would be gay bashing because obviously that did go on. People think of the 80s, you know, this great time, but there was, obviously Section 28 and AIDS, and there was a real climate of fear. Mm. But in a way, you could read Mark so openly. And, I mean, he didn't write a song like, both of you wrote a song like Relax. That wasn't what Soft Cell were about, but the fact they were tapping into that whole kind of early 80s Soho sort of sleaze sex. I mean, they really put sex on the agenda in a way that a lot of pop groups didn't. And I think if you really knew your stuff, you could see that, you know, that it was kind of so obvious, even though Mark didn't have to, didn't say that
he
was
gay. Yeah, there were no
Bucks Fizz. It was so blatant.
Later in the show, we'll be talking about Day's book as well as The Looming Tower, the dramatisation of the months leading up to 9/11, now running on BBC Two. Can an event of this magnitude make for enjoyable TV? And how soon is too soon? Plus, speaking soothing music that won't shred your nerves, the new album from well-heeled New York ethno-pop outfit Vampire Weekend, and that big Avengers bit at the very end. All that after this quick reminder from Andrew.
Remember, you can get every episode of Big Mouth a day early if you support us on Patreon, the crowdfunder for independent creators like us. Pledge us the price of a pint each month, a very reasonable £5 at pre-Brexit prices, and we will send you each and every new episode on Fridays, straight off the editing bench. The extra bit for Patreon backers is taking a breather this week as we've got the big Avengers bit, but every other week you'll get an additional bit of Big Mouth just for Patreon backers. Send us a £5 each month to help us cover our studio bills and keep us in business. Our gratitude will be enormous. Search Patreon Big Mouth or look at the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Okay, before we go back to Soft Cell, there's a free EP with the book to show you I've been there. Dave, tell us about it. What is this stuff here on this free record?
Well, that was it was a continuation of the first EP we put out. Was called Mutant Moments, and my manager Chris Smith said it'd be great to have like a little vinyl. It was like almost like an imaginary continuation of the first EP, and so I changed the name to it was Magic Mutants, because obviously we originally it was based on the Perry Como Magic Moments. So then we had Mutant Moments, and I said, well, what about Magic Mutants? And I redid the sleeve as I'd done. Well, Mark actually did the B side of the first sleeve, but I think he was away, so I ended up doing both sides of the cover, which is great. And it's and it's basically there's three of our older tracks, which I'm trying to remember what they are, so to speak. Science Fiction Stories is one of them.
Girl with a
Patent Leather Face, which was originally on the Some Bizarre album when we just first got a proper record deal. And it's also we also got a version of the Fad Gadget track Back to Nature, which was basically like a little sort of nod to Frank Tovey, who was actually at college with us, and unfortunately he kind of died very young, and he was such a talented kind of genius, you know. And so it's a nod to, in fact, Mark even says that for Frank on the record, and it even features me doing some of my robotic vocals. So it's a kind of duet. It's a duet between me and Mark. So that's you're in for a treat when you hear that one, I suppose.
Well, we're not going to play that one. We're going to play Science Fiction Stories instead.
Well, funny enough, I wrote that because I got my first synthesizer in '78, which was a second-hand thing. It was a Korg, a mini Korg DV800, and it used to belong to the drummer of Jethro Tull. And I got it for the princely sum of like 400 quid or something in a shop in Blackpool. And then I was at college at Leeds, and I was working in the sound room there, and I started writing these stupid little songs, and Mark and I started working together on performances, and he said, oh, can I sing on some of your songs, replace my vocals? Because I was never really a singer, and so that was actually the first song I ever wrote, really.
I love the idea of Soft Cell with a synthesizer called DV8.
It's perfect, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. It's Science Fiction Stories from Magic Mutants EP.
Science fiction stories told us our future. Science fiction stories not to be forgotten. Science fiction stories told us our future. Science fiction stories not to be forgotten.
So the book is a visual diary of Soft Cell from Leeds in 1979, and it's very evocative and it's very funny. There's Mark thinking that he's Paul Rodgers with his mic stand, and you up on the Acropolis boiling to death in your leather because you wouldn't take your leather off.
I had with me.
it's one of the hottest countries in Europe, Dave. Did you not plan ahead? Bands often look at their happiest when they're kind of starting out and it's all new. Was that kind of the case for you guys?
Well, I think it is because it's a It's a great adventure, and you've not been sort of touring around the world for kind of a few years and in like a different hotel room every night and doing loads of TV appearances and radio appearances. And I mean, I can remember doing like promotional weeks in Europe, and you just sort of fly out. I mean, we were living in Leeds still at the time. We'd fly out from Leeds Airport, go to Belgium, so we'd do some stuff in Brussels in the morning, then fly on to, say, to Amsterdam, do some more of the same, then fly back via, sort of, I don't know, France or something, do some more, and then come back to Leeds. And the next day you'd fly up to Germany, have a couple of days, go to Berlin, do some more to Frankfurt and Dusseldorf and Hamburg for a couple of days. And you basically, you'd done the same interview about 12 times a day. And probably that was radio, TV and press and the photo shoots and everything. And it was just like, it was mind-numbing. So yeah. I think once you've done that for a bit, you sort of dread going out there, you know.
Yeah.
But initially it was great because it was like, I'd never been to Athens, you know. I'd never been to Los Angeles. I'd never been to, you know, all these amazing new places.
Yeah. That the connection between you and Mark, I mean, it's one of the sort of great sort of crossovers of, like, everything from sort of, you know, loving electronics to loving, you know, bizarre cabaret, but mainly a big load of old sleaze and naughtiness. We're actually in a basement in Soho right now, so you must feel like
I feel right at home.
Was it the case that kind of he introduced you to the sleazy world of, you know, Raincoats and Mucky Mags and all that kind of thing that became the soft salt imprimatur, or were you a bit that way anyway?
Well, I think I was always interested. I mean, I think my sort of interest in sort of that more sort of dangerous sounding music was when I was watching the early Bond films. And my dad used to take me to the cinema, which was like, I had a lifelong, like, love affair with the music of John Barry, you know. And that was a massive influence. And I saw all the early Bond films, and there was something very kind of naughty and dangerous about them. I mean, obviously,
it was basically the sexiest thing you could get hold of in those days, wasn't it? The Bond title sequences.
Exactly, just the Bond girls and all that stuff and the fast cars and the sort of violence. But the music was, like, thrilling, you know. And it's like, so I was always kind of, I knew I liked that sort of edginess and stuff. And you know, because I grew up in Blackpool, and Blackpool was quite sort of lots of neon, and it was quite sleazy around Blackpool. There's a lot of stuff went on in the back streets of Blackpool, you know. It had its kind of grimy sort of underbelly, you know. So yeah, there was always an interest in that.
It certainly did, yeah. There's a bit in the book, there's pictures of the Sex Dwarf video, the infamous Sex Dwarf video, which has got nudity and chainsaws and all kinds of things. It's actually,
and lots of bits of meat hanging in the background.
This was obviously banned, probably made to be banned, I would have thought.
I think we didn't really think about it as a commercial entity. I think we just thought whatever we could just do whatever we liked and it would be accepted. And I think it was W.H. Smith said, we're not going to stock this, and all the major retailers like HMV and Virgin said, we're not stocking it. So we got a complete ban. And we had kind of own money invested in that, because there was obviously the videos for the singles were on there, but we'd paid for all the extras.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, there's no point in putting it out if it's going to be banned everywhere. So we kind of withdrew the original video and just did a cleaned up joke version of, with us reading from the lyric sheets. But
and yet, last year.
But it got us some great press.
Yes, absolutely. And yet, last year you did, I think, probably the biggest box set any band has ever done in the history of box sets, and you didn't put the Sex Dwarf video on it. Why is this?
I don't know. It's the honest
answer. Really
I don't. I quite honestly don't know where even if the master tape exists.
Oh.
And if people want it, they, you can get sort of pretty bad quality versions of it on YouTube. But I think that the master tape has sort of disappeared, and so I've no idea. And it would just not have been good enough quality apart from anything else. It's the poor quality that you get on YouTube. So
it would be a very soft sell thing to have to get it in a brown paper bag.
I was
shocked. did I read your mind?
That's what our programmes were like at the O2, if you remember. The programmes for the show came in a brown, an unmarked brown paper bag.
I think it's disgusting.
I think it's hilarious.
You like it, really.
But what's really quite funny, though, because Mark was always very kind of dubious. He's going, I don't want to do that song ever again. I think he had quite a few reservations about it. And I was going, no, Pete, the crowd love it. We've got to do it. It's a crowd pleaser. And sure enough, you know, he kind of said, OK. And we did it at the O2. And I saw a little, I think it was a thing on one of Mark's many internet kind of boards, whatever you call them. And he said that his mum, who was at the gig, who's about 80 years old, was, he said, last seen at the O2 singing along to the chorus of Sex Bomb, sitting two seats away from Andrew Lloyd Webber. I thought that's kind of interesting.
And just moving on from the thought of Sex Dwarf the musical.
I really need to play that at the
DJ Care. If that doesn't get
if that doesn't get some action, I'm in.
Okay. Let's move on from Sugar and Spice, luring disco dollies to a life of vice, and Dave's CD world. Over to the hinge of history, the September the 11th attacks. And specifically, what a fantastic link that was.
Partridge there.
Yes, well, full Partridge. Specifically, the months before, which are now being dramatised in The Looming Tower, which is appearing on BBC Two right now. Lawrence White's book of the same name is considered the work on how American intelligence failed to spot the greatest threat to the country since Pearl Harbor, and it's now a 10-part miniseries. Here's a taster.
This isn't a war about one man. His people actually believe.
You are making a mistake, sir. Someday this administration will be remembered for the risks it didn't take. This
world is... What I need you for is to figure out what happens next so we can stop it.
Bin Laden has made these threats before, but this time, he put a time cap on it.
Use the chain of command. It exists for a reason.
Them who are here in the room, to those who are watching on television, your government failed you.
The Looming Tower of Teaser there. Thank you, Sean. Now, cards on the table. I thought this was absolutely excellent, riveting, beautifully put together, incredibly powerful. Martin, what did you think? Less so.
Yeah. Well, no, it's just the last time that I was on Big Mouth, you asked me to watch program Poland 1983. So that was the Cold War, and that was. And now I'm watching something.
We're all about the laughs on this show.
Yeah, and now this is kind of the hot war in the sense that. You know, the Cold War, in a way, wasn't fought, but it was all kind of underground. This is obviously so real. And I think that I found it uncomfortable of how real it is. Yeah. And yet at the same time, it's like, I mean, it looks beautiful. It's like Mad Men. It's just everything about it. But there's just something jarring for me, just the way that the kind of clash between the kind of how real it really is and the drama that they put into it. I mean, the head of the FBI says, you know, things like, I'm going to ram that hard drive so far up your arse that you're going to have to, like, you know, decode it via your dentist or something like that. You know, they say at the start, this is based on a true story, but events have been conflated and dramatized.
Yeah.
And I always have a problem with the aspect of, did this really happen or is this dramatised? Mm. Did the guy from the FBI really say that? And I don't know. But it is compelling. And what I really liked about it was the fact that even though I know about the story, I don't really know the real details that went on between the FBI and CIA and which lies at the root of 9/11.
I mean, the setup of it is we are following the way that US intelligence, basically, the left hand is not talking to the right hand, and is in fact fighting with the right hand, while behind it, the very determined, very focused Al-Qaeda team are building to their climactic attack.
It's horribly gripping.
It's horribly gripping, but it's the dramatic irony of we know exactly what's going to happen that drives the whole thing. The fact that there are literal Looming Tower moments. There's a character will be flitting across New York in a cab and you'll see the Twin Towers behind.
They interject, you know, footage of Bin Laden within a made-up scene. So,
I found that really interesting.
Personally, I want a documentary of that rather than a dramatization, which is fictionalized. But it's, I mean,
Sir Ben Kingsley as Osama, that kind of thing.
Sorry,
you want to see Sir Ben Kingsley as Osama, giving us his Osama. Sean, what did you make of it? Did you enjoy it?
Well, I think I'm going with the Martin Aston vibe on this one. The dramatisation, it's only 17 years ago. It feels a bit soon. As soon as I turned it on, all I could think of, because this is a son's favourites, Team America. where you've got some white people going after some people who are talking in Arabic, and you're thinking, this is cliched from the start. We are here from the point of view of the white guys. And then reading up a bit about Lawrence White's book, 80% of it is not the point of view of the white guys fighting what is evil or wrong, or it's about
its homeland,
environment of it. It's about geopolitics. It's about the world. And I just felt, I don't know what is true, what is false, but I'm having to be one of the FBI or CIA, and I'm not really comfortable with that. I don't know. I don't really like the bombs. I actually got into it enough to actually find it quite frightening in that way of. This just reminds me of that time, and there's still a problem in that and making that entertainment. Who is it entertaining, and why are we going with what the white guys are doing and what we're
I think there's that kind of complicated form of entertainment you get from when you are watching or discovering or learning about something that is extremely real and genuinely terrifying, and in which thousands of real human beings died. Yet you can appreciate the sort of both the dramatic approach to it, and you can appreciate. You know, it's not exactly entertaining, but it is kind of enriching to understand the world around you a bit
better. Well, I'd say read the book. Don't turn it into
having,
a drama.
You know, the real thing. I mean, do we need to know that the FBI chief has two mistresses and kind of... I don't think that that's pertinent or...
Well, it's a metaphor for America and fucking everybody.
Or is it, though? I mean, I don't know whether... You know, what we're essentially seeing is that American intelligence is about to have a horrendous wake-up call, and they have not been taking the threat seriously, anywhere near as seriously as the internecine squabbling between their own agencies.
Yeah, but then
and
we've
that's
got...
the big change.
We've got however many episodes of that where we see, as you're saying, left hand is not talking to the right hand, or vice versa. And, that's the gag. We've turned it into a gag. We've turned it into a very one-dimensional thing of what real problem is.
Yeah,
I say gag, obviously, in masses. Yeah.
Dave, you weren't sold on this, were you?
No, of course it's rubbish. I don't really like all the sort of American overproduced kind of series anyway. I'm not a big fan. I think the last box sets I watched was Breaking Bad and The Sopranos, and I kind of gave up after that. Really, but I agree with what you were saying, to read the book. I think I'd much rather read the book before I watched... I'd watch that series after reading the book, because I think, you know, all the drama they've kind of injected into it and all this sort of these other little plots that are going on, I think, are probably irrelevant and fictitious, really.
Yeah. But it's not either or, is it? I mean,
it's not really entertainment either.
Well, it's.
Sort of coming across almost as if it's trying to be a sort of historical sort of document in a way. And it's kind of more like propaganda, really.
Well, I don't know. I mean, entertainment and Hollywood are how America deals with its history. You know, we could be a class society
and
an ancient society. But they also deal with it.
The version of events.
It's also a point of debate, isn't it? Because a grand historical event will take place, the movie will be made, and that will be what occasions the debate, that people agree with or disagree with it. I mean, personally, I really enjoyed it as a piece of drama.
As a piece of entertainment. If you thought, it's just fictitious and forget that it's supposed to be based. But it's like, I suppose it's like watching any films about, you know, the Second World War or something. Yeah. I mean, if the Germans had won, the outcome would be, I mean, apart from the obvious, you know, but it would be the version of events would be totally different.
It probably would be quite different. You're absolutely right on that one. It would be a German for a kickoff. Interesting, the title of the thing is drawn from a surah in the Quran, which Osama bin Laden repeated three times at a wedding in the weeks before 9/11, and it is, wherever you are, death will find you, even if you are in lofty or looming towers, which is kind of... I mean, that's massive hint, that, isn't it? They really were not taking the hint from Osama and not taking it seriously. Yeah. I mean, what I found most powerful about it was seeing those scenes of the way the world was before this, where you could be... a clearly Arab guy in full mufti with an artificial leg taking photographs of the American embassy on a giant, clearly visible camera, and nobody stops you. And that, to me, was the real kind of... That's when the cold hand closed around my digestive system.
Well, the world...
In the way in which the world had changed.
Yeah, the world changed.
I always think it was significant that it was September 11th. the 11 as well is, you know,
well,
like
it is
the Twin Towers, isn't it?
It is the great, kind of, you know, it was a massive, massive message, and it was designed to be like
that.
Yeah. Anyway, is it the kind of television that you think you ought to watch? You know, I should be watching.
I mean, I was just, when I watched it, I just remember being on the top of one of those towers with my mum and my sister in 1978, and that was kind of, I remember the first time I went back to New York after the towers had gone, and it was so weird, kind of coming into New York from JFK, and it's like, where are the towers?
It's like,
you're so used to it being part of the skyline, just like like the Empire State and the Chrysler, and it's like, oh, it's gone. It's a very weird, weird experience, that.
Astonishing. Well, I'm going to stick with the Looming Tower, because and then I'm going to read the book, so we're all,
they're all happy.
Absolutely.
Fine, let's cheer ourselves up after that. Every week we ask the guests to bring in a tune for the listeners' entertainment and edification. Martin Aston, what have you brought for us?
I've brought in Contact, which is a song by Big Thief from a new album, their first album for 4AD, weirdly enough, though.
Ooh.
I did love the band before they signed to, you know, so I'm not
being...
They're a four-piece from Brooklyn with... there's been a whole sort of spate of US acts and a kind of confessional, I mean, whether it's Phoebe Bridges or Lucy Dacus or Snail Mail or Soccer Mum, Juliet Baker. There's just, I mean, really, really good singer-songwriters. But everything is kind of confessional and very sort of angsty. And what I love about Big Thief is that there's this kind of aura of mystery about them. I mean, the album is called UFOF. And apparently F stands for friends. And really, I have no idea why UFO friends. And and it's not just that there's this aura of mystery, but it's the most, it's this beautiful, intoxicating song, which has a real sort of sense of drama to it, and yet I don't understand it. And just the whole, you know, a combination of that, it's just such a brilliant song.
Wonderful. Let's have a listen. Contact by Big Thief. To New York's fashionable Upper East Side, which is quite different to where we are in a Soho bunker, and the fourth album from preppy former Afrobeaters, Vampire Weekend. Father of the Bride is the first in 6 years, and in today's hectic, accelerated pop environment, you might as well be starting from scratch. But Ezra Koenig and chums are back with what is effectively a double album. And former member Rostam Batmanghelli, who left in 2013, is sort of back too. But is it any good? Here's a track from Father of the Bride, This Life.
Baby, I know pain is as natural as the rain. I just thought it didn't rain in California. Baby, I know love isn't what I thought it was, 'cause I've never known love like this before.
Clean and serene, well-scrubbed sounds of Vampire Weekend. Martin Aston, I'm going to start with you. Is this your sort of thing?
It is my sort of thing, yes. Again, what I really like about Ezra and Ezra Koenig, who basically is these days Vampire Weekend since Rostam left, is that you just can't easily read him. You just don't know. You know, the band have this sort of Ivy League preppy image.
Yeah.
But at the same time, are they sort of playing it up? Are they? Do they really think that they, that, you know, are they serious? I mean, there's a kind of element of irony and satire. And, I mean, he just seemingly just can write the most amazing hooks time and time again. I mean, this record has 18 tracks. I mean, it's her first album in 6 years.
Yes.
So maybe you could see it as one album every 3 years and there's only, you know, and there's only 9 tracks per album or something. But it's still, every single track has a kind of a real hook to it. And, you know, Paul Simon's Graceland is their kind of blueprint, I would say.
Right. That puts me off.
But it... I'll get my coat now.
No, you carry on.
No, I just like his lyrics. They're, you know, they're thoughtful. Some of the album is about sort of, I mean, he's now married and he has a kid. He's not sort of talking about college days. Mm. And some of it is, there's a kind of almost sort of sappy love songs. And there's a couple, I think there's three duets with Danielle Haim, one of the Haim sisters. It's kind of cornball. And yet he's also writing about sort of Jewish identity. And I just find him really fascinating because he's really thoughtful in interviews. But you just have to go back to the record, and it's just, you know, hook after hook. And so it has this kind of sparkling, it's sort of afro
yes,
pop.
Yes, it's very bright and
it's
clean.
It's very
bright
and clean. And yet there's kind of there's lyrics about anxiety, depression, identity. And yet, I mean, and Ezra talks about the fact that he was, when he was, you know, younger, quite a sort of anxious teen. And quite angsty, and yet the music is this really uplifting, sparkling pop music, and it's just a really good combination.
Okay, Dave Ball, I can't imagine this is your cup of tea.
Not really. No.
What did you think?
Well, they're one of those bands that I've been aware of them for a long time. I've never really listened to their stuff. They sort of they've gone under my radar, really. I mean, I've always heard the singles, like the current single, is it Harmony Hall,
yeah. Harmony Hall.
Which is one of those ones I keep hearing. I think, what's that? That's really good. And it's like, oh, it's Vampire Weekend. I quite like this band. So I've kind of felt like I need to investigate. So maybe this will be the first time I'll actually invest in an album and have a listen. Because they really sort of passed me by in a way. And I didn't realise...
18 songs is quite hard to take in. Well, maybe in one go, that's the problem. So listen to 9 and then you know, 3 years later you can listen to the other 9.
Tell you what though, music business, this proves the show sells records. We just sold one to Dave Ball.
Hey, there you go. But do you often listen to stuff that's outside of electronica? You're not too boxed in?
Well, I listen to all sorts, really. I mean, I always go back a lot to kind of classical music and film soundtracks. Those are, you know, and obviously I've still got a very big thing about soul music. It's very broad, broad stuff. I've recently been listening to a lot of kind of old sort of kind of German electronic sort of stuff, a lot of the early krautrock kind of stuff, which I really like as well. But, yeah, I kind of tend to go more for instrumental stuff rather than vocal stuff. I mean, that's more my kind of bag, really. Unless it's soul music or some decent 60s pop.
Andrew, you had to give this a couple of listens, you said earlier.
Well, to be honest with you, when I first heard it, I absolutely detested it, and it really, really left me worse than cold. It kind of repelled me. I thought it was intolerably twee and NPR, and I found it really quite annoying.
I was
sitting there thinking, Simon and Garfunkel already exists, so why do we need this? And then I listened to it again, and I actually started to like it. I started to melt a little bit, and it sort of proved the rule, actually, that I've found in my life, that the music you detest most when you first encounter it, you actually do often quite find yourself enjoying. One of my favourite bands of all time, Madness, for the first time I saw them on Top of the Pops, I thought it was silly and annoying and stupid.
You were four years old at the time, so you might,
I was a fair bit older than that, Martin. Very flattering to say that, Martin. A fair bit older. And within a few weeks, I'm my favourite band. So I actually started to... I think you're right in that there's hook after hook. And I think you're... what I found interesting was the kind of... The sonic palette's quite interesting. Yeah. It kind of expands. I've just said what I found interesting is that it was quite interesting. What I found quite interesting was the sonic palette opens up a little
bit. And you said sonic palette.
A sonic palette twice, yeah. Sonic cathedrals of sound. you know, the Sympathy's got a bit of Central American energy to it. And I think, you know, my remaining objection to it is that it's a bit low energy. It's a bit campfire. It's a bit lacking in kind of oomph. But there's quite a lot of grandeur
in
there.
Turn it up.
Yeah, well, I mean, as usual, I think everybody should be using drum machines, but, you know, and octave bass lines. But I actually started to like it a lot more than my initial repulsed reaction. There's some interestingly awkward beats and a nice kind of vocal dooby-dooby construction thing on Sunflower. And, you know, there's enough little kind of grace notes and wobbly distortions.
Yeah,
I found the subject matter a little bit impenetrable. I'm not that interested in the kind of millennial angst of, you know, Yale people and Harvard people.
But I think that's what they used to be. And I think, I mean, he's now 35 and I don't think he's actually tapping into that, to be honest.
Well, maybe. Well, I mean, you know the band a lot more than me, but sorry, Sean.
I disagree with the jolly line on Harmony Hall. It's jolly, jolly, jolly. And then we go, I don't want to live like this, but I don't want to die. And I thought, you are not 17.
Occasionally. Grow up. Yeah, no, true. But I mean, it's a very, it is quite a wordy record. Mm. And there are a few clangers that yes. you think, had he been, I mean, he is basically Vampire Weekend. And you yeah. think that if Rostam had still been in the band, he might have said, take that line out. Or, you know, somebody, right. he needs maybe a peer, an editor or somebody to say, OK, maybe not, because it's very much his own thing. And so no one's going to challenge him, I think. But, yeah,
I just kept thinking, a few clunkers. I just kept thinking, Wes Anderson, and that kind of, that the feel of a Wes Anderson yes. film really has put a lot of people off. Some people really love it, but that's the issue with the strong identity in anything, isn't it? Mm. I can't say this is going to go down as my favourite record of all time, but I am no longer going to avoid it like the plague as I was going to when I first heard it.
I'm going to go back and avoid it like the plague. I found it really difficult. I drift off. I found it twee, bright and twee, and then all these, I'm slightly suicidal lyrics. I found it hard to like. And I thought Vampire Weekend were going to be a lot more goth. Disappointed. Oh. I was hoping for a bit of something ridiculous.
There is a track called Unbearably White.
Yes.
Which is about criticisms of indie rock and them in particular. Mm. Because I think somebody on Pitchfork or something said this band are unbearably white.
It's also apparently about an impending avalanche, as in heavy snow, and about a blank page that he's trying to write with a blank page. So I think that the whole aspect of white has different levels on it. I don't think it's just a piss take.
Is it an avalanche of snowflakes? An avalanche of precious
avocado
snowflakes.
Avocado on toast.
So what
What's
I'm saying,
wrong with avocado on toast? Come on.
You millennial.
Yes, millennial.
Yeah, right.
So what I'm saying is I was unfair to it when I first heard it, and I think I should be more fair to it.
Yeah, avocado on toast. Delicious.
So that's probably a 2.5 out of 4 on that one. Let's have one more tune before we switch it all up and go into Avengers Perda. Dave, you've brought in a tune for us. What have you brought in?
I've brought in Johnny Marr's Armatopia, which I like it because I like the play on words, Armageddon, Utopia or Dystopia, whichever way. And what I like really about this, though, because I think Johnny's great, he's a brilliant guitarist. I once worked with him briefly on a track, but I love this sort of T-Rexiness of this track. It just really reminds me of some of those early Mark Boland sort of things like Metal Guru and stuff. It's just got a great feel to it, and so I like it.
You're thinking Armageddon, and I'm thinking Armley. This is Armatopia.
Yeah.
Time for the fake ending of the show before we go into our post-credit sequence to talk about Avengers Endgame. So let's do closing time chatter. Martin Aston, what's your talking point for the week?
Well, I think it's a kind of reaction to the looming tower and the sort of the heaviness of that. And what I want to engage with more is in honour of Soft Cell as well, because I think there was a real sort of element of, you know, celebrating elements of trash, our culture and kitsch. And I think the fact that it's the 25th anniversary of Showgirls.
Oh, yeah?
Paul Verhoeven's film. There is not one but two documentaries coming out, and there's been even an art exhibition.
Oh.
Now, this is this is a film that's been called cinematic equivalent of a pile of garbage eating a cheeseburger. And I think it's won more Razzies, which is the kind of, you know, bad film version of the Oscars, than any other film. And it is an extraordinarily bad piece of work. I mean, it is gloriously awful. And I love the fact that it's now being kind of rethought as a kind of, you know, I mean, people at the time said that Verhoeven was, you know, that he wasn't just misogynist, and it wasn't just an awful film. It was a very sort of blatant comment about America and about Vegas and consumerism. And now people are talking about, in the era of Me Too, that it's a comment on exploitation of women. And I think you can read all of that into it, and yet at the same time, it's a sort of all about Eve with sparkling nipple.
They should put that on the poster, actually, Martin. That got that very well. So it's the 25th anniversary of this, and there are events around it.
It's the 25th anniversary, and, well, there's, two documentaries, mm-hmm. and I just love the fact, one, it's an incredibly entertaining film with really quotable lines. I mean, even I think 3 months after the film was out, or maybe 6 months, they were showing it late night screenings in Manhattan that people would dress up and spout the lines. It was like a kind of Rocky Horror show that happened really fast because people really recognised how truly awful and great it was. And I just like the fact that it's come back round and that people are going to talk about it as this kind of work of art, which I don't know about.
But it is.
It is a work of art in the sense that it is a film. But, I mean, it's a story basically about a young woman who kind of comes to Vegas to make it, and she comes into contact with the kind of the older Vegas glamour stripper, model, dancer, which is the all about Eve, a storyline about, the young usurper. But it's so crass, and there's just so many clunky lines. It's hysterical.
A beautiful work of art.
A beautiful work of art. Dave, so anyway, trash.
Sounds like Soft Cell should record a new soundtrack for Showgirls. Well, Dave, what's your closing time chatter? Closing time chatter, your talking point of the week.
Mine's it's a bit sort of darker than that, and it's all this stuff. So my ears pricked up because I was listening to Radio 4 and John Humphreys kept talking about tainted blood. And it's all the scandal about all the blood products that were given to people back in the late 70s and early 80s and a lot of people that contracted HIV and died and stuff. And it just because they kept saying tainted blood. And the weird thing was that my ex-wife at the time, we had our first child in 1984 and she had to have a blood transfusion, and I remember thinking at the time, it's like, do you think that they've actually kind of checked this screen, this blood? And then you had those adverts on TV. Do you remember the age is a killer?
Ignorance.
And it was kind of, it's all that weird, heavy times.
And also, was it Coyle that did a version of Tainted Love?
Well, that was the other thing. Tainted Love took on a new meaning. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it was originally a B-side in 1965 for Gloria Jones. Then we did it. And obviously, because of the sort of campness of our version, and then you had the advent of HIV and AIDS, and then Coyle did this sort of slowed down, kind of doom laden version,
the video.
which gave it a much more kind of dark. So it's that word tainted. It keeps haunting me.
The promo video is set in a cemetery. So.
Yeah. Keep it light, Patrick.
Puts my Showgirls trash closing chatter into perspective.
We're all about the yin and the yang. Come on, Sean, rescue the show.
I'm going to try, but mine's a bit. It's not doomy, but it's RIP corner because I just wanted to say that John Singleton, who has died recently, was an amazing black film director. 1991 drama Boys in the Hood, which is an incredible film. He's died. Let's hope this is a celebration of what he did in film, but what he did for people trying to break into filmmaking who aren't white men. Everybody. It's 51 as well. It's no age. Absolutely not. But let's hope to say this turns around the celebration of films and they're seen a lot more and that people can go forth and take that spark of inspiration and life force and put it into more filmmaking because it is revolutionary. It's so hard to get a film made anyway. If you are of a minority, it is even harder or have something different to say. So let's go away for him.
Yes, absolutely. R.I.P. John Singleton. Well, mine's a little bit less serious. It's a good bit less serious, actually. I've noticed lately, three great instances this week of very, very serious magazines taking stupid pop culture things very, very seriously in a very amusing way. So the big battle on Game of Thrones on Monday, which this is not a spoiler to mention this at all, but there was the major, kind of climactic battle took place on Monday night's episode of Game of Thrones. And Wired magazine got a military tactician to analyse Jon Snow's tactics, Jon Snow and Daenerys, Mrs. Dragons, their tactics in the battle against the White Walkers and the Army of the Dead. an actual member of the US Army who said, well, I mean, the tactics are terrible. You know, they should have placed a holding defence here. They should have been, flanking here. They had amazing air support in the form of two dragons, which they did not use. There's a lesson here from this battle that happened in 300 BC. It's brilliant, brilliant analysis of the battle from a military point of view.
I was thinking what the same right Avengers Endgame, actually. Why are we all piling in together? I don't think this is a tactic.
So there was that. We'll put that on the Facebook page. Wired's military tactician talking about Game of Thrones. Yeah. What would be the right way to combat an army of undead monsters who can't die if all you've got on your side is a bunch of eunuchs and two dragons? Very, very interesting. And then Joe, the internet website joe.ie, very amusing Irish website, they gave player ratings for everybody in the Battle of Winterfell as if it was a football match. Not since Manchester United turned around the 1999 European Cup final has there been such a massive switch at the absolute death.
Pop culture will eat itself.
Pop culture will eat itself. And it's full of great lines about how, the Night King really did not justify his selection, and he's going to be very disappointed with this away fixture. Sadly, it looks like this is going to be coming towards the end of the career of this team, so a lot of rebuilding needed on the side of the undead, so that's really good. And then just to cap it all off, Avengers Endgame, the FT did a great piece on Thanos, Economist. You don't know, this is not a spoiler. Martin's putting his fingers in his ear. So Thanos, you already know what Thanos has killed half the universe. And the FT analysed it from an economics point of view. How does that work? Has he cut off the demand required to keep the universal economy moving? Should he not be thinking more about redistribution of resources? What tradition is he in? Is he a Malthusian, which we'll talk about in the extra bit at the end of the show? Where does he fit into the economic... The conclusion they came to is a very, very bad economist. But he's definitely the most famous economist in the universe right
Thanos,
now.
Yeah,
Thanos. Thanonomics.
He's a very naughty boy.
Very, very naughty boy. So I encourage you to look those up. We'll put them all on the Facebook page because they're all good reads. And that's the end of the main show. And if you're listening on Soho Radio, that's the end of the whole show because we're not going to put the Avengers bit on because we don't want passing listeners to have the movie ruined for them, as we nearly ruined it for Martin just then. You should have seen his face. Dave Ball, thanks for coming in and being our guest.
Welcome, my pleasure.
I believe you're working with the grid as well at the moment again.
We're doing some stuff with Richard Norris, which is good fun. That's like an ongoing sort of project with Richard and I. We did an album using a Moog System 55, which is the massive Keith Emerson-style modular system, which came up limited edition. But we're doing some new stuff, and we're going to probably put a sort of box set type thing together over the next year. So
fantastic. Are you going to call it the National Grid?
The National Grid, yes.
Thanks for coming in. Yep, and the book's great. The book's really fun. Where can people get the book?
The launch is, in Soho. Yeah. The launch is, it will have been and gone, won't it, when this goes out? Was Thursday. So
can they get it at softsell.com?
Yeah, there's various outlets. I think Lexa Music and softsell.com, but I think it's only limited to like 1,300.
Yeah.
So I think that we've sold about half of them already. Mm. So
the annotations. Were you and Mark talking about
they are very
great. For the annotation, your story with the pictures is really good.
Thanks for coming in, Dave. Martin Aston, thank you for joining us. What are you working on next? What's your next bit?
What's my next bit? I've just been writing about the Flaming Lips and the Soft Bulletin, 20th anniversary, and they're coming over and doing some shows. I've just done a piece on them, and now I'm doing a piece on Eno's Apollo soundtracks and atmospheres, because that's getting a reissue with an extra CD. It's all about the extra tracks, isn't it?
It is.
Or about the anniversaries and stuff like that.
Well, we'll look forward to Martin Aston's Eno collaboration coming soon. Thanks to producer Sophie Black as well for pushing all the buttons. Now, Sian and I entered the quantum realm to talk Avengers Endgame with film critic Linda Marek and career nerd Michael Moran. I know it's going to work because I don't know what I'll do if it doesn't. Hello and welcome back to our spoiler-heavy dissection of Avengers Endgame, the climax to 22 Marvel movies and 45 wasted years of my life. If you haven't seen the film yet, stop listening right now. Go away. Do not come back until you've seen it, because we're going to be ruining the film for you otherwise. Okay? Have you gone? You've gone. Sean and I have got our geek team with us for the Avengers bit. Film critic Linda Marek. Hello, Linda. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And man about the internet and big mouth regular Michael Moran. Hello, Michael Moran.
How do you do?
Not bad. Thank you very much. Now, first off, overall impressions, Avengers Endgame. Did it deliver? Was it what you wanted, Linda?
It did. It did deliver, and it was exactly what I wanted. But I have some reservations.
Okay. What are your reservations?
I think The structure was the right structure, having the three times. I don't think it needed to be as long as it was, for starters.
I thought it was too short.
I know we had to tie up like 22 movies at the same time, but at the same, I think there were bits that were really, really slow that didn't need to be as slow as they were, and I think we could have done 2.5 hours would have been absolutely fine, in my opinion.
Harsh room. Michael Moran. Like me, you've been waiting all of your life for this film.
Yes,
the payoff on these characters. And the gist, I mean, obviously, if you've got this far, you know what the gist is. That it's how do we reverse the Thanos snap? How do we stop half the universe from being destroyed? Half of the living creatures in the universe being erased, rather. And that great sort of opening fake move where the Route 1 superhero thing, go and kill the bad guy, they do it, they succeed, and it makes no difference.
Yeah. Mm.
They've failed. Did you enjoy it as a...
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a deserved victory lap for the team, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were certainly some kind of self-indulgent moments. There was a lot of inside baseball referencing and stuff. But I don't care, personally. I loved it.
Well, that idea of inside baseball, I mean, I've talked to people who are saying, I'm going to go and see this film. I haven't seen any Marvel films before. Do you think I'll enjoy it? And I'm like, well, you wouldn't read the last chapter of a book.
No.
You know. But I sort of felt that the inside baseball stuff, you know, the relationship between Captain America and Bucky, for instance, becomes a really important shift in the plot or shift in the action. Minutiae, such as the fact that, you know, in the funeral scene at the end, as well as all the characters, you see the kid who was Tony Stark's sidekick in Iron Man 3, kind of all grown up. All these things, they don't just serve action, they also serve character, and they show you how this isn't just a beat-em-up thing about superpowers. It's about characters changing and growing and becoming different people.
Mm.
Sean, you're probably the least committed of us lots. You go under sufferance in a half Nelson with your 13-year-old son. What did you make of it?
Well, having now been educated by my son in all things Marvel, I think the only one I haven't seen in the last 10 years is Captain Marvel. I really enjoyed it, and I thought it is a much better film than Infinity War. I understood it. You need to be part of the gang. That's what we're saying here. But I thought that it was the structure was actually really good. The fact that you've got to tie in, is it 22 stories?
Yeah.
And you have to have characters who wouldn't necessarily be in the same universe together.
Yeah.
All of that I thought was done miraculously well. It was engaging. It's funny at the right bits because, you know, it can sometimes get a little bit stodgy when we're dealing with the big stuff and life and death and obviously alternate universes and timelines. But it managed to tread a line, and tonally I think it is the best Marvel so far in going from light to dark and then in the medium. Really enjoyed it. I knew it was going to be 3 hours, so I had prepared. I had been to the toilet. I had been food. Yeah, there were a lot of people coming and going in that film.
Yeah, no,
there was a lot of ladders.
I was troubled by that. This notion that 3 hours is too long to sit still.
I thought it was wonderful. That makes it an event.
What's wrong with you? I mean, sure, if you do have like some flavour of disability that means you have to get a little bit, fair enough. But the average person should be capable of sitting still for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And if you can't, shut up, get out of the
movies. I actually thought it was the fastest 3 hours of my life, but you're saying, is it that you were talking about the inside baseball thing. Isn't like literally everybody in the world in the gang now? Everybody knows who Thanos is.
Yeah.
Everybody knows who the key characters are all brand characters.
And you can also swat up very, very easily, can't you? We have the internet in case you don't know who
Wikipedia,
anyone
is. Just one look at Wikipedia at the moment.
But also these characters, they are, by nature, because they're superheroes, high-concept characters. They're very easy to understand.
Yes.
God of Thunder, Black Widow, she's an assassin from
Russia. They're colour-coded as well. They tick all boxes in
so jumping up. Although at the screening I went to in London's Glittering Wood Green, somebody brought a baby, which I thought that was optimistic. I don't think a baby would enjoy it.
Was it still a baby at the end?
It was still a baby, yeah.
I've said what I didn't like about it, but I think what I liked about it the most is that it did sort of a victory lap, as you said, but it also did like the solemn, somber stuff really, really well. And in contrast with the Zack Snyder and DC stuff, who always say that they're more solemn, they're more sort of serious. I think their seriousness is not half as sort of heartening as the Marvel stuff.
Well,
it's just so beautifully done.
Somebody said about the Zack Snyder DC movies, they are an adolescent idea of what grown up is.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a lot of violence and it's a lot of a lot of sort of grittiness. Whereas that's actually genuine adult take on life is possible in this, because really, what we're looking at is the culmination of several psychological arcs of individuals who, when we meet them, are terribly, terribly damaged.
Yeah.
And I thought the slow burn intro, I thought the opening scene where Hawkeye loses his family was an absolute heartbreaker.
Yes. Yeah.
And it made this ridiculous, you know, sci-fi Stan Lee looniness premise really very real. And
yeah, when it made we meet it very personal.
Yeah, so we meet them all. Everybody's damaged after the Thanos finger snap. Tony Stark is, firstly, he's raging unreasonably, and then he just withdraws, takes himself off the board. Thor has hidden in drink and Fortnite. We can talk a little about that later. Black Widow is trying to cope by becoming the boss. She's trying to control
She's
it all.
She's working her way out of it.
Hawkeye has gone criminally insane. And actually, interestingly, the only person who's able to cope is Captain America, because he's used to... He has lost everything before. He understands it, which is, to me, that's why Captain America remains the most... compelling character, you know, because he's like he's dependable.
Hawkeye has gone full Snyder.
He's fallen sideways into a DC movie.
Yeah.
And actually, when Black Widow finds him in Japan, the look on her face and the relationship between Black Widow and Hawkeye is brilliant. We'll talk about that in a minute as well. But she's like, what the hell has happened to you, man?
Yes.
You are being directed by Zack Snyder now. What has happened to you? It is actually the story of how everybody repairs themselves, isn't it? And you get to see, you know, several characters meet their lost mums and dads, which is what time travel is for, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Little kids, when offered time travel, say, I want to see a dinosaur. Grown-ups like, I want to see my nan. And, I would like to see my nan again. And the scenes between Howard Stark and Tony Stark, the great lovely. John Slattery from Mad Men, that's just, for me, that was worth...
Wonderful, that was really lovely.
Yeah.
And Thor meeting Freya, his mum, or Frigga.
Yeah.
So, you know, and getting some wise advice. I thought there was great god stuff going on there, because the cyclical nature of the Norse gods, she knows she's going to die.
Yeah.
She knows Ragnarok is coming. Ragnarok comes, and then the gods are reborn over and over again. I think that depth of kind of mythical stuff in
wisdom.
It.
Wisdom she has. And if you did have a mum like Renee Russo, you would really want to go and see her again.
Can we also talk about the sort of the gender stuff that some people have... seem to have, you know, objected to. You know, there's one particular scene which I call the girl power scene, in which sort of the gauntlet is passed from one female superhero to the other, which I loved. I personally really liked
Baby
it,
Avenger.
And I totally understand that some people might find that a bit cringy, but I don't know what you guys thought of it.
I thought it was a big pleasing glop of fan service that had made no narrative sense.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter, because it's a victory lap. That's
absolutely
fine. They're allowed these things.
That was the only bit in the film that I thought I sort of smelled the Infinity shoehorn being wielded. But I was wondering, and the fact that you've got all the female characters basically defending weedy adolescent Spider-Man, I thought was kind of quite nice. But nothing else felt shoehorned in, even though, I read, reading up previously, and on the genesis of the movie, that Marvel's market research had found that the thing that people wanted more than anything else was for Captain America and Peggy to get together and be happy.
Yes.
What we get.
I loved that. I mean,
really?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what they wanted.
I've always found them an adorable, compelling couple. I always believed that relationship. I thought it was well played between the pair of them.
I mean, we're often told that like good movies give you not what you want, but what you don't know you want.
Yeah.
But I think this kind of plays against it a little bit, because
everything
that Steve Rogers has been through is, he firstly, loses the love of his life, he loses his entire world, he's thrown into this chaotic modern world he doesn't fully understand, and then there's the big Infinity War thing where literally 50% of everything, his face is ground in it like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And the way in which it's not his superpowers, it's his character, and that's the case with all of them. It's not their abilities, it's their character that enables them to overcome this. And I thought that, as an old guy, the more you go through life, you do have to confront failure. You do have to confront being the loser.
Yeah.
I thought that's actual heroism.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter whether you can fly and you got a hammer.
Black Widow giving up the thing that she most treasured was heroism.
Well, let's talk about that, because some people have said, have complained that Black Widow got a raw deal in this, in that, it's got to be the woman who dies, and there's a great big funeral for Tony Stark, but there's no great big funeral for Black Widow, and that, that she's kind of, treated in the kind of offhand way that a lot of female characters often are in genre. What do we think about that?
I thought she saved the universe. I thought that was fine. I thought, and she went out knowing that she had to do it. No, the thing about her as a character, as I see it, is that she was at some point off screen quite a bad character.
Yes.
And then she found herself among the Avengers, and she found a sense of family she'd never had before and a sense of purpose she'd never had before.
Yeah.
She had to give up that thing she cared about the most, that meant the most to her, in order to exchange it all for the Soul Stone, which if she hadn't done, half of the people in the universe would have stayed dead. So it was a huge hero moment.
It does kind of thematically fit because Hawkeye wants to save his family.
Yeah.
Tony Stark wants to save the new family that he has, And that great dilemma of if we solve this, if we undo what Thanos has done, my kid's going to disappear.
Yeah.
I thought that was a genuine power. That was like a Marvel Sophie's Choice. It's like a really difficult thing that perhaps goes over the heads of the kids in the room, but I think the adults really got it. The scene, that sort of final scene between Hawkeye and Black Widow, as they're tussling on the cliff edge. Wants to go over the edge. Yeah. I thought that was the relationship between them, which is a great platonic love story. You know, they're not involved, but they are like partners.
Yeah, as close as they could be.
And each of them wants to be the one.
I thought her ending was deliberately ambiguous. That's probably why there wasn't such a big thing made out of. There wasn't a big funeral or anything sort of talked about. I have a feeling that,
Well, I was thinking about this, I was thinking, in phase two, very much Marvel opened the cosmic side of their universe. Mm. So we had Guardians of the Galaxy, Dark World was an immeasurably more cosmic Thor film than Thor. In phase three, maybe they're going to, or phase four now, they're going to start unravelling the multidimensional side of the universe. They're basically going to go full DC. And you may not be a prequel. Maybe it's a parallel universe.
I really
story.
Hope not, actually. Because I think not.
I think they're giving themselves a load of trouble. But
as a lifelong, tragic comics fan, the thing I hate most is the fact that stakes are not real and they never really die. Mm. So when they die, it doesn't matter. And I actually, much as I love the Black Widow character, and I think she's not been fully developed, I think there's more in there. I actually want her to stay dead. I wanted Gamora to stay dead because that makes it real.
Yeah,
I mean, if you can never die, if everything can always be undone, and of course this is the problem of introducing time travel at all, or if there are alternative universes where it didn't matter, I think it makes things less important.
Well, that's the problem that half of the characters in the film are that have been turned to dust. So we don't know whether they're going to come back through another portal, as it were, or she's going to stay dead. I thought that was still a question mark because I didn't read anything about it before I went to see it.
I thought that was really sort of contentious, to be honest.
So they're already doing that. Yeah. We've killed them. We haven't killed them.
But there's death and there's death. And it's made pretty clear.
Yeah, but there could be also death. Dead, Marvel are the gods here. They are deciding what to do.
Because they quietly unkilled Loki in this as well.
Yes.
Through a side. So I hope we're not going to get into this kind of tomb. I thought it was a mistake when they brought Coulson back. Agent Coulson should have stayed dead. That's stakes. He's been rubbish since. Stakes. We've got to have proper stakes.
Yeah.
Speaking of dying, what do we think of the Stark arc?
Well, I was just about to ask that. Because my first question to my son, who is, as I say, is a bit of an aficionado now, maybe not as much as you, Andrew, was, did you feel sad when Iron Man died? We have this story. He knows the story of Stark. He's seen the Iron Man films. Did you feel sadness? And he said, oh, my God, yes. And
I said,
well, I didn't at all.
I did because of the kids, I think.
I see.
Yeah.
There's something still dislikable about Stark.
But that's kind of his thing. He is an annoying character. That's
a
part of the whole, slightly arrogant billionaire playboy philanthropist. Being slightly full of himself is part of his shtick. He's not perfect.
Michael and I have been working on a prequel called Tony Stark, Rich Asshole.
Yeah.
And we may well get you if we get into a prequel. I was sad, but I was glad he died.
Was he the right person to die?
I think so, because I actually wanted a few more heroic deaths in this. Because I am here for a last stand. I'm here for full sacrifice. Okay. What gets
me. Who would have you done over?
I felt a little bit cheated that we didn't get an heroic Captain America death.
Amazing. Yeah, rather than him on the bench, I think
they would have taken me out in a stretcher if he'd died.
But I am fully happy with him turning into John Kerry, John McCain on the bench.
Love him.
In his leisure wear. Yeah. I'm happy with that. That's okay.
Yeah.
What did we make? What did we make? I know, Linda, you mentioned this bit before we started recording. You didn't like what happened with Thor.
No, I didn't.
You don't like Thor on the couch.
Well, I mean, I know it's funny and he's the butt of all the jokes of the fat jokes. I just wanted him to be Thor, I just wanted him to sort of wallow in his misery for a bit and then
But yeah, he kind of does.
I think that's entirely.
He's got two hammers, for God's sake.
Yeah, he's dual wielding. Yeah,
I don't know,
video game.
But I just didn't like that. The whole. I mean, I think it's really funny, and I think that they do funny and solemn really well. That's the good thing about Marvel. Mm. But I don't know, that whole arc.
But didn't you think though? Because the great thing about the core combination of Avengers, they're all different personality types, and Thor, for all of his power. Is a big kid.
Is it very childish?
And the great thing about comics characters is, although they're superhuman, they're actually a little bit less than human. They're a bit less. They're not as fully integrated.
So
Thor basically goes to his room and plays video games because he's really sad and angry, and he can't confront his actual loss, not just of his failure, but also of his mum and Asgard. Mm-hmm. I thought that was actually quite real.
Yeah. I really like that.
The idea of somebody putting on a stack of weight and playing video games and becoming really depressed spoke to me very personally.
I found Tony Stark's reaction very plausible as well. It's like, well, if being the world's most being a genius billionaire technologist doesn't work, well, I'm just going to give it all up. I'm not going to do any of it. I'm going to sit in a log cabin and do nothing.
Because that didn't work, so to hell with it.
Yeah. Captain America, we see him pass on the shield to Sam Wilson. Is there any point to a Captain America who didn't fight in the Second World War?
Yes.
Is there? Do you think?
I don't know. I was thinking, is there any point in a Captain America who is not a super soldier, who is just this? He's just some guy. He's some guy with some wings.
Well, Captain America's superpower is not necessarily being super strong. It is his character. It is being Captain America. It is being the guy who just won't
quit. Can do it all day.
Yeah. So I don't know, because I don't think you need that back, because he represents a simpler America when America knew it was right.
Yeah.
Before we started recording the show, talking about would Captain America have been a Republican?
He's frozen in time, and he's kind of like...
And I think he would be, but he'd be an Eisenhower Republican. Yeah. He'd be bring the country together Republican. Yeah.
But obviously he represents America, and America changes, like we all do, countries do geopolitics, blah, blah, blah. And so it's about the new America. I think it's really important. It's about pushing the past back and then going forth. I mean, I don't know all of Sam Wilson's backstory as a character, but I imagine there's going to be extra tendrils are going to be introduced, and we're going to see where he's coming from.
There'll be a lot more to unpack because we'll have more time to do that.
He's a war veteran, but of a different and a much more complicated war.
I was cheering, you know.
Yeah, really, I don't find him very interesting. I mean, like for me, someone to replace Captain America, they have to be an extraordinary kind of... person.
Let's see.
The issue that you've got is that Captain America is the most uncomplicated character in the Marvel universe.
And my least favourite, I would say him in the Dark Knight.
But everybody that's been generated subsequently is a complicated person, you know, and then, you know, so. But it's clearly it's going to be developed, isn't it? Mm. Now, Sean, you want to talk about Thanos? You don't know whether Thanos is a bad guy or not, do you?
Well, it was more that I find Thanos very cardboard. And I find him as
he's not
the
real.
Bad guy. Really? What a chin. I find the idea of the archetype of the bad guy that he follows so strictly difficult. Is one of the one characters where I just go, no, I don't get it. I don't get you. You're made up. Yeah, you're made up. Whereas the others are kind of fleshed out.
Well, his plan makes no sense whatsoever.
No.
None.
But there's no real psychological force behind it,
I agree.
He's the laughable bit. So at the beginning, I'm thinking, I'm really not going to enjoy this. And, oh, yeah, he's already dead. Okay, fine. But as we get, the ensemble together, I get it.
I actually really like him as a villain. He is a Malthusian monster who believes that he says he believes that solving the problems of the universe can be achieved by wiping out half the population of the universe. Yes, it's bonkers, but the psychological truth behind it is he's not killing billions of people because he wants to save the universe. He's killing them because fundamentally he wants to kill billions of people. Sometimes you can't make an omelette without breaking the eggs. Some people just want to break the eggs. There is a psychopathy behind that I found actually a great bit of villainy.
I would say that Marvel struggle, though, with his relationship with his daughters as well. They can obviously see the dad, maybe a good side in him, but he doesn't have one. And I find that really tenuous. It's just really hard to grasp on or hook on.
When he
that.
Doesn't have a good side, I think that they've just been sort of like used to being with him.
They see their lives.
Hot woke take. He's an abusive father and a tyrannical, toxic male character who thinks that he can impose his will on the entire universe. I'm imposing my will on this podcast.
You could comfortably draw a parallel between him and sort of religious fundamentalism and world terrorism.
Yes, it's that art. But that is three-dimensional, and I still find him two-dimensional.
I think my problem with Thanos is at no point do I see... Why don't we know what he's really motivated by? There is one thing that must have happened in his past.
Yes, exactly. Where is the history that turned him
that? I really hate it when movies do that. I don't want to know that Darth Vader is bad because he lost his mum when he was little.
No, you can do it clunky, you can do it well.
The thing is, it has been spelled out. It has been spelled out that his world went to shit. Titan went to shit because it was overpopulated. And that sort of engendered within him this notion that if we could just reduce the overpopulation, then everything would be fine. It's a stupid idea, I grant you, but that's the idea.
And we're right back to Brexit and you.
Yeah.
We should probably wrap it up there because we could talk about this for hours and days. But I was emotionally exhausted by the end of this. Yeah. I felt like everything I'd invested in this since reading Spider-Man Comics Weekly and Mighty World of Marvel in 1973 was fully paid off. And I don't know what I'm going to do with my life now. I have to start reading grown-up
things. Are you going to carry on with the Marvel movies, with Spider-Man? With whatever happened, because I have thought about drawing a line here. I think I've said this before, that I now accept that this franchise will outlive me, and I am wondering whether there just comes a point where I go, right, this is the end of the story for me. Can I just keep going back to this bloody thing? The idea that it's ended here.
The fundamentally great thing about Endgame is it is the end of something, and of course, endings are always beginnings.
It is the end,
I thought that is a. You never get enough of that.
Yeah, there's no after-credit tease.
No.
Also, like the J.G. Ballard reference, there is a story in the book that the officer at reception was reading called Endgame. Terminal Beach, of course.
Yeah,
I really like that.
Well, that's the end of our Avengers Endgame assessment. Thank you, Linda, Michael and Sean, for sticking around. And the only thing to say at the end of this is, to be continued, ..